check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Russian media tells us little about massive wildfires in Siberia this summer, but the European Eyes on the Earth, the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service, can see it directly. Smoke from those fires traveled around the world. Dr. Mark Parrington is a senior scientist at the European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts. He works on the Copernicus Project, and they've tracked over 100 big wildfires in the Arctic Circle just since June. Mark, please tell us what satellite images reveal about the 2019 fires in Siberia so far.
Yes, hi, Alex. So in the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service, we're using satellite observations of active fires. So these aren't specifically like the visible images that you often see in the media. It's measuring like heat signals at the surface. And these heat signals come from fires, of course, but they can also come from other cases, such as volcanoes and gas flaring and things like this. We use that data because it's available in near real time, and it also gives us a means of estimating the heat output from fires. And from that, we can then estimate emissions of different pollutants and aerosols. And we want to do that because we're running atmospheric composition or air quality forecasts, if you like, in much the same way that weather forecasts are produced. And that these fire emissions are a source of pollution, and we want to have those as accurate and timely as possible so that we can then track where the smoke goes. It's also true, however, that there are then visible satellite images, and what they show is then what the status of the surface looks like. So you can see smoke in them, you can see burn scars in them, and you can see how big the fires grow to. It's slightly different information to what we use in CAMS and what we provide in CAMS, but the two of them together are very complementary and give us a very clear picture of what's happening in global fires, and in particular in Siberia and the Arctic Circle over the last couple of months.
Compared to past years, is this an unusual fire season in Siberia?
So using the data that we have, those satellite observations that I just described, in the summer, I would expect that we see some fire detections within the Arctic Circle and especially across Siberia outside of the Arctic Circle during their fire season. But what seems to be the case this year is that there's just been far more of those detections, and they've been quite localized in quite specific regions, particularly within the Arctic Circle. And what's been really unusual is that they've really lasted for such a long period of time. I first noticed these around the second week of June, and they've only really sort of died down and gone back to more average values, if you like, over the last 7 to 10 days or so. So that's nearly 3 months of very high intensity fire activity, which is quite unusual.
In the middle of August, on Twitter, you predicted smoke from Siberian wildfires would cross the Arctic Ocean to reach northern Greenland. Did that happen?
That's right. So in our service, we're producing five-day forecasts of smoke, if you like, particularly when there's significant fire activity. And as well as the fires in the Arctic Circle in Siberia, there's also been quite significant fire activity in central Siberia outside of the Arctic Circle. And during the first couple of weeks of August, there was really significant fire activity in Krasnoyarsk Krai and Irkutsk in central Siberia. And there was a lot of information on Twitter showing that there was this so-called dome of smoke that covered, you know, many thousands of square kilometers over central and eastern Siberia. And in our five-day forecasts of the smoke aerosol, we saw that a plume of this smoke from those fires was predicted to really head up into the high Arctic, cross the North Pole, and reach more or less the north coast of Greenland. And that was persistent in our forecast for a number of days. We haven't been able to fully verify just what the extent of how that smoke transport occurred with independent data yet. One of the challenges with looking at smoke from satellite observations is that if we only use visible imagery, it's sometimes often easy to lose track of the smoke. You don't necessarily see it against the Earth's surface below. But the data that we're using in our system are observations of the aerosol content in the atmosphere. So this isn't just using visible imagery. So we can actually see then where there is aerosol in the atmosphere that we wouldn't necessarily be able to see by eye. But one of the critical steps of the work that we do is that we verify our forecasts against independent measurements from the ground, which generally, just anecdotally, generally show that our forecasts are usually quite reliable in predicting these kind of smoke transport events.
You know, I pictured the Arctic wind system generally circling around the pole from west to east. So how did smoke from Siberia manage to get to Greenland over the Arctic Ocean?
This is a good point. There's in general, the atmospheric circulation is from west to east in the Northern Hemisphere. So you have these very well-defined and very well-known upper level, the polar jets. So you have the jet stream, which is carrying air from west to east, going around the pole, as you say. However, there are changes, day-to-day changes in the synoptic scale weather patterns. And it's not that unusual for then the weather patterns to change in such a way that air masses can travel in slightly different pathways, including going across the pole or even going sort of counter to the direction of the jet streams. It's not an uncommon event, but it's highly variable, and it's similar to how we see weather patterns changing day to day in the weather forecast on the news or on other media.
Mark, do you think the amount of smoke reaching Greenland would be significant enough to darken the ice there, leading to even more warming?
This is also an important point. I think if we consider the Siberian fires in June, and we think of the near field effects, so those fires were occurring quite close to the Arctic coast in northern Russia, and in that case, there seems to have been some observation that there was some deposition of soot or black carbon to the sea ice with visible imagery. In the case of where the transport is that much longer, i.e. crossing from Eurasia all the way across the pole to the European Arctic and North American Arctic in Greenland and Northern Canada, usually what we find is when you have those kind of long-range transport events, that the aerosol is higher in altitude in the atmosphere. And so it's not easy to find where it's interacting then with the ground. We do have data in our system, which we haven't yet had a look at. We haven't yet had time to look at, which gives us an estimate of how much aerosol is deposited at the surface. And I think once we have a look at that data, it will be able to help us work out whether smoke from those fires did actually reach the surface over Greenland. And if that is the case, then there is the possibility of that soot being deposited on the ice sheet and accelerating melting local to that deposition.
What did you see regarding smoke from wildfires in Alaska this past summer?
Okay, well, Alaska also contributed quite significantly to the wildfire emissions in the Arctic Circle around the end of June, beginning of July. And for sure, they did produce huge amounts of smoke. And so we saw a lot of that did seem to hang around locally around central Alaska and Fairbanks, where there was a lot of air quality measurements were showing very high values. And generally what seemed to be the case with that smoke is there was a long range transport event which carried that smoke across Canada as far as the Great Lakes, where I think there was also some reports I think I remember seeing of enhanced air quality in those regions related to the transport of smoke from those fires.
So the Copernicus system can measure aerosols, including wildfire smoke, and you've given us a couple of clues, but since it's not directly visible always by satellite, how do you do it?
Okay, well, this is a very complicated process. We have our model of global atmospheric composition. And so this is essentially a weather model, a weather prediction model, the European Centre's weather prediction model. So we know it's a very good weather prediction model. And into that model, we've included all kinds of things related to emissions of aerosols and pollutants and all of it, and different gases. and also the chemistry of the air, of how those gases react with each other and with aerosols. And so modeling is one thing, but then the way we have some accuracy or have some confidence in our forecast is that we initialize each forecast based on satellite observations.
I remember seeing news stories from the big, big fires in the west of North America last year. The smoke actually reached Europe. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, that's right. I've been monitoring these now for the last few summers in quite close detail. And it's quite a common occurrence each summer that we would see smoke being transported right across the Atlantic to European airspace, where it is also then measured by independent sources. So far this year, there hasn't been too much of that. There was a case at the end of May with the really big fires that were occurring in northern Alberta at that time, where I think we did see one of these long-range transport events, and I think people in Western Europe were reporting the skies having a very red tint to them early one morning, which was coincident with the transport of that smoke across to us. And then there's been other cases in other years as well. I think one of the really famous cases in recent years was a pyroconvective event, which injected aerosol into the stratosphere above British Columbia. And this was smoke that persisted in the lower stratosphere for several months and was detected over Europe for quite some time.
Are scientists really convinced that global warming has led to more wildfires in northern latitudes? And if so, what should we expect in the future?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. What seems to be the case, at least for the Arctic fires this year, was that in June, where those fires originally started in the Siberian part of the Arctic, is when we looked at the climate monitoring that we do. So at ECMWF, we run CAMS, but we also run the Copernicus Climate Change Service, C3S. And every month they produce a climate bulletin, which looks at anomalies in surface temperature and precipitation, humidity, soil moisture, these kind of things. And in that case, the fires in the Arctic, in Siberia, for sure were occurring in a place where those anomalies were stronger. So there was a strong positive temperature anomaly up to maybe 10 degrees above the climatology, and also very dry conditions. And so it seems very clear this year for the Arctic that fires have been occurring where it's warmer and drier. And this was something that was predicted in the scientific literature a few years ago. And so essentially it's difficult to get a very clear signal between climate change and wildfires, because the wildfires require that or a mechanism of ignition. And you might have the perfect conditions, but if there isn't an ignition, then you won't get any fire. But when it is warmer and drier through a changing climate, when there is that mechanism for ignition, then fires are able to potentially persist for many weeks, as has been the case of what we've seen across the Arctic Circle in the summer of 2019.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Mark Parrington, senior scientist for the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service. We're talking about fire and smoke as the Earth heats up. So my next question for you, Mark, maybe it's too early to answer because all the figures aren't in, but do you have a sense of how the fires in the Arctic this summer compared to fires in Amazon or in African Congo and Angola? How significant are these Arctic fires on a global scale?
Well, I think they're significant in themselves, just for the location that they are occurring. It's not really possible to compare those fires with those in the Amazon or those in tropical Africa, in much the same way that it's not really possible to compare the fires in the Amazon with the fires in tropical Africa either. I mean, the circumstances are all very different. What's burning is very different, and how the carbon cycle is responding to that is different as well. We can estimate something in terms of the equivalent carbon dioxide that's emitted, and that's in a way, that's useful for giving some context when we compare against fossil fuel emissions from different countries, for example. But to really compare what's happening in Siberia against the Amazon, against tropical Africa, is not really a possibility.
Are the impacts of northern wildfire smoke limited to the Arctic? For example, could smoke from some of those fires cause breathing problems for some people in northern Europe?
Well, no. So the impact, clearly the impacts on air quality of wildfires is very, very strong and very severe, very close to where the fires are burning. And as we discussed a little bit earlier, though, we do see these so-called long-range transport of pollution events. So this occurs because some of the constituents in smoke, so you think of smoke, it's aerosols, but then there's also a lot of other reactive gases and trace gases in there, and some of those are very unpleasant to breathe and very, very harmful to human health. And some of those constituents can also persist in the atmosphere for several days to weeks and months even. And so what that means is when the smoke is picked up by the winds and transported thousands of kilometers downwind, when that air mass then descends into the boundary layer or descends into closer to the surface in populated areas, then it will exacerbate any local air pollution effect. So there is a possibility that smoke from fires can affect air quality and people's day-to-day health, you know, a long way from the source.
We're often told that smoke, for example, from volcanoes can actually cause cooling by shielding out some of the sun's energy. Does that apply to the northern smoke your team studied this summer, Mark? Can we have heat and yet a sort of cooling effect at the same time?
We can. This is true. It's a very complicated process in how the smoke interacts with radiation in the atmosphere. This is essentially what we're looking at. This is something that I and some colleagues have been studying in the Arctic for a number of years, where when we see smoke transport events into the high Arctic, we can then look at what that means in terms of the solar radiation that can get to the surface. So as you say, this cooling mechanism would be that you have a cloud of smoke and it reflects solar radiation back to space. So, and that would ultimately lead to a cooling at the surface. And we do see that. We see a signal in the radiation change when that smoke is there, of a cooling of some degree at the surface, local to where the smoke plume is. However, it is much more complicated because there are indirect effects of aerosol on radiation, which can actually lead to a heating as well. So depending on what constituents there are in the smoke, it doesn't necessarily mean that there will always be a net cooling effect in this case. It's a very difficult thing to estimate. We do have the data to estimate it, and it is an active area of research. It's not something we can very quickly give answers to as the events are occurring.
You know, these days, a lot of my information comes from all kinds of people on Twitter, and it's my experience that social media is sometimes far ahead of what scientists tell us. In addition to the tools like satellites that you've talked about, are climate experts also crunching social media to see what people on the ground are reporting?
This isn't something that we do in our service, and it's not something that we're able to do. But I am aware that I think there are some researchers out there which are looking into how social media reports for events related to, say, wildfires or volcanoes or air pollution in general, if that data can be mined to then, you know, provide extra information for forecasts and that. But currently, this isn't something that we incorporate in our service.
Why does the European Union fund the kind of global research your unit makes available to every government and even to the public?
Well, the idea is that with the Copernicus program is to be able to provide free and open access data to everybody, partly as a means of developing applications and for broadening the knowledge of environmental issues to everybody. It's not, in this day and age, it's not enough for an organization to say, well, we know that there's smoke here or there's this fire there, really the data needs to be free and open access, so that you're not just taking our word for it. You can actually go and get your hands on that data and see for yourself.
What is the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecast? Who funds it and what does it do?
So here at the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecast, we're an intergovernmental organisation in Europe. We're a research institute and a 24/7 operational service. And what that means is we produce global weather predictions and other data for our member and cooperating states. So we're an international organization, and we're funded by different European governments that make up our member states.
Can you give us any tips on how our listeners can use data from Copernicus?
Well, sure. I mean, so one of the ways Copernicus works is, on the one hand, is to provide satellite data, and there is, you know, different online tools for then looking at different satellite data provided by Copernicus. But what we have in CAMS, and also with the climate change service that I mentioned, is these are data services which take Earth observation data from satellites and put it, you know, with a particular application. So in our case, it's atmospheric composition. And the idea being that it makes that data a bit more understandable, a bit more usable for users. So rather than, you know, so you're sitting at home listening to this and you think, oh, I want to learn, know more about aerosol from satellites. You can take the satellite data, but sometimes that's quite tricky to use because it's quite a specialized data set. There's lots of gaps in it, and interpreting it can be quite tricky. But what we do is, by assimilating that into our model, we get then a much smoother field, and it's something that is maybe a bit easier to interpret when you look at it. In the first instance, what I would recommend is there's a number of mobile phone apps out there which are taking our data to then get that data more directly to users. And on our website, which is atmosphere.copernicus.eu, there are various links to some of those applications.
And as we wrap up here, what are the key things we still need to know in your field, and what are you working on next?
I think the key thing for us in CAMS is how we best manage with this huge wealth of data that we have available from satellites. We're currently using data from a fleet of satellites, some of which have been going for a very long time. I think 20 years is probably the longest one now. And on the horizon, we already have in our sites a number of other satellite missions for monitoring atmospheric composition, which we will also make use of in our service. Perhaps the next big thing on the horizon, though, is the use of geostationary satellites for atmospheric composition and air quality. So currently, the satellites we use, they go around in orbits, and they pass the equator at more or less the same local solar time each overpass. But what that means is then you get maybe one or two overpasses per day for where you're located. With the geostationary, it sits in the same position, and it will then observe at a much higher time frequency. So with the other satellites, we get very good observations once a day or so, but with the geostationary, we'll get observations over a much wider area with much higher frequency. So we'll really then be able to see how fires or atmospheric pollution is changing on a much higher time resolution.
From Europe, we have been speaking with Dr. Mark Parrington, Senior Scientist for Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service. To learn more, you can find links in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.